I mean, I'm just lazy. So it's great just not shaving. You know?
Yeah, and you get a cool beard out of it.
Yeah. Well, I get a beard. I don't know if it's cool, but I like it. My wife's okay with it. That's all that matters, I think.
Hi.
Yeah. My wife is also cool with it when I do it. I had a pretty sweet mustache. Well, sweet to me mustache last summer when I was like waxing.
Oh, yeah.
And then I got bored.
Yeah, so I get that going on the
Awesome.
So what's up, man?
Weird day. Today's Thursday, right? And kind of been running around. We're going to Michigan this weekend to visit my family, which is pretty cool. Not to like start on a bummer, but we found out 2 days ago that my dad has prostate cancer.
Ooh.
Which sucks.
Yeah.
And I wasn't gonna go to Michigan, my wife was with my kids, but I'm changed my plans and I'm taking the weekend off and going there. So that's kind of like getting ready to be out of here kind of thing. Back during COVID, I heard this advertisement on the radio saying that there's this like, it's called Buffalo. I live in the Buffalo area. It's called a Buffalo Literacy Center, and they needed tutors to like help teach adults in basic literacy. And so that's like English as a second language, but also English speakers who just are behind in literacy. So
yeah,
like I said, it was back during COVID. I heard this thing. I was like, hey, I like have extra time and could do that, and would think I would kind of like it. Plus, I've kind of I'm like 12 minutes south. It's 12 miles south of the city of Buffalo, and we don't have a ton of contact with them. And I thought, you know, hey, I'll probably give me a chance to get connected to people, you know, meet some people I wouldn't otherwise meet in my nice suburb, you know. And so I signed up for this thing, and it took like 8 months before they assigned me to someone. And it was like in January this year, and I was like, well, I said I'd do it. I went through the training, and now every Thursday at noon, I have a two-hour appointment no matter what, and I do not have the time I had in COVID, and so Thursdays are like wild. But I met a guy that I really like, and I get to work with him every week, and I get to choose what we read. So
the Bible. Good.
He told me that the reason he wants to read is that he can't read his Bible, and he told me that before he knew I was a pastor.
Wow.
Which is perfect. Pretty darn cool. But today we're in every session by having like I read something and he reads, he just follows along with his eyes, you know, like he practices most of the session, and we kind of have been working through different short stories. And so today we started a Flannery O'Connor short story, which is, you know, because I get to choose. So anyway, so Thursdays are kind of wild, and this one in particular. But
yeah, I had the day off from my day job. And I had to, so a little bit of a whoopsie here. I did not pay my vehicle taxes for like over a year, like 2 years.
That is over a year.
Yeah. So my vehicle taxes were due in June.
Uh-huh.
Like 2021.
Okay.
So I didn't pay them for that year, and then I didn't pay them for 2022 when June rolled back around. So, I mean, you know, and June was only like 3 weeks ago, I guess. But I last time I paid taxes on that vehicle was in 2020.
Yeah.
So I had to go out today and take care of that.
Is it like a property tax on the value of the vehicle? Oh, we don't do that up here. Please
okay.
don't tell New York about that, because they're going to be like, we could have been doing that this whole time.
What? I lived in Arizona, and you only pay property tax on the vehicle one time out there, but it's at the time of purchase, and the amount is so great they have to roll it into your loan.
I literally am in the process of buying a vehicle, and I have to. It's going to be like $3,000 I have to pay. Yeah. Oof. It's wild.
Yeah. So I had to go take care of that today because it's my day off from the day job. But I also needed to drop some pipes off at the tobacco shop to get them refurbished. I had to get a haircut, I had to get the vehicle inspected and have my oil changed before I can pay the taxes and renew the registration on it. And a buddy of mine, he's a soldier, and he's having a shindig, so I had to go get a visitor's pass to get on post. And I went and did all of those things. All of those things in 3 hours. I was shocked.
That's pretty awesome.
Shocked. Yeah.
So I have a, I actually have a brother down there. He lives in Pinehurst.
Cool. He's, yeah, it's not far.
But he's on, I mean, he's at the base, so he's down there. And he has complained about similar things, like the taxes and the inspection. But it sounds like it went okay, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. When I went to the DMV, which usually I was seriously budgeting 90 minutes to be at this DMV.
Yeah.
And when I got there, there was only one person in line ahead of me, so I was in and out in 20 minutes. But on my way out, the line had already grown to out the door and around the building. In like 20 minutes, everybody showed up. And I was like, wow, just barely beat
that one. You know, back in the 90s, we would have said that's a God thing.
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Totally. I actually thanked God on my way out for that. And then it made me realize that, like, this whole day, like, the fact that I went and got the oil change and everything and got all of it done in 3 hours, yeah. No, it's totally a God thing.
Well, I think the thing that I've been thinking, because, I mean, what is a God thing? Maybe a question. But I think I've been thinking is the God thing is that you're thankful to him for it. You know what I mean? Like, that's the actual God thing. Because a lot of, you know, like, I mean, any number of wicked people could have had the same experience. Mm-hmm. And the thing they would have been missing is the gratitude. And so the God right. thing is that you actually get to be like, hey, God, I had a good day and you were sovereign the whole time. So thank you. Thanks. That's a God thing.
Yeah. We used to have a word for it. Providence.
Yeah.
It's what we would ascribe all of this to. I don't know if you've ever read like any of like George Washington's like letters or anything sort of from that time period, 1700s, 1800s. But everything was, you know, by the guiding hand of Providence, we were able to do this safely today, you know, and it's a reference to God mostly. I mean, probably just culturally, but it's a reference to divine providence, to God being sovereign, leading and ordering things. You know, that used to be built into the culture, you know.
Right. Yeah. I wonder, you know, like, was it, I mean, I guess people have written a lot to say that, you know, maybe mindless references to providence, you know, built into the culture aren't all that helpful in making us actually thankful, you know, to God. Right. But I tend to think it's pretty cool when you already have the language in your, mm-hmm. you know, in your repertoire. And so I think it's good that we say, you know, God bless and thank God when things go well or when we say goodbye, even if we don't mean it. I would rather just try to impart some meaning into the thing we already have there personally.
Yeah. But. Yeah. I talked to a guy one time. He was kind of like atheist, I guess. And he said, you know, I really want to be a Christian. I just can't, I can't believe. It's impossible to me. I don't get it. But like, I really wish I could. What do I do? Right now I'm going to a church and, you know, I feel so fake. What do I do? And I was like, just keep going. Just keep, you know, it's like push start in a car, you know, just keep doing the thing. And who knows? Might click on for you.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're able to say like, I wish that I could, right? Because like, if that's true, then you already have the motions down. That's a pretty good step, right? So was that, I'm curious, is that before or after you came to the Lutheran side?
After.
Because it's so representative of just the Lutheran theology of like the word and the means of grace, right? To say like, oh, no. The best place for you to be is the place where promises of Jesus are getting thrown around a lot. Like that's the place we want you to be. And that's such like an awkward thing, because it is such like a constant conversation, even amongst Christians, you know, like does go if going to church, you know, you know, going to church doesn't make you a Christian anymore than standing in a garage makes you a car, you know, kind of thing. I don't really think that's true.
Same.
I think that church is where we that's where most of us were made into Christians. So
Yeah. And even if you hang around long enough, you know.
Yeah, right. So a better comparison, it would be a car factory, not a garage. Whatever. It's the place where things are made. Yeah, that's right. The providence as a thing we like. I think that, like, if you could just like take on the idea of providence a little bit into like a daily life. I mean, I think a lot of people, it could start to be a freeing thing. So like it reminds me a little bit of like our Lutheran doctrine of vocation, right? So like when I don't have providence, everything, I have freedom to do whatever I want. And that is like a problem because my life sucks, you know. I could easily think that like, hey, I've got absolute freedom and that puts me at the center of everything I'm experiencing, which is a bummer because I don't think I've done a very good job with my freedom, right? You might think this way. When you start to get vocation and say, well, yep, you have, you know, freedom as a Christian. You have the ability to make some choices that will do some things. But also, like, if you're at McDonald's and handing a drink out the window, we give you permission to say, God is using my hand to hand this person a drink right now. He's giving them the beverage they need or want or whatever. He's giving them a good gift, and I get to be part of it. And all of a sudden, providence even then kind of gets intertwined with your choices, and it's a thing that sets you free, you know?
Yes.
Which is, you know, really, like, the core of the bondage of the will, I think. Just you get set free, actually, in that. In a way that I'm thankful for.
It's also empowering in a way. I don't know. I think I've brought this up before on the podcast, but have you ever read Dracula?
I have not.
Great book. You should read it. Really good book. It's just set up as a series. It's basically a found footage film, but like, you know, before movies. So the whole book, Bram Stoker wrote it as a series of letters and journal entries and stuff like this that were compiled after the fact.
Okay.
But there's this part at the very end where they're halfway across Europe and they're hunting down Dracula and they're going to kill him. This hardy band of Anglicans. And one of the guys, the only American on the trip, he says, what I can't understand is why God would allow such an evil to exist instead of exterminating it. Like, why wouldn't God get rid of this evil thing from the earth? And Dr. Van Helsing says, well, my dear boy, he is getting rid of this evil thing through us. He's using us to get rid of the evil thing.
Yeah.
And so in this way, providence is like, it's empowering. It's like, you know, Jesus said, you know, go be my hands and feet or whatnot. And, you know, here you are, like, actually doing the thing.
Yeah, that's right. And it also means that, like, whatever little thing you have in front of you is purposeful, too, which is pretty darn cool to kind of believe that. It also reshapes kind of a daily discipleship walk for a person too, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, so Gene Veith is our great kind of vocation writer in the Lutheran world. That's how I think of him anyway. and he's got this great little thing where he talks about this, like, the mom who is forced to just choose between feeding the crying baby or reading her Bible. Like, one more day. Like, she's got to make a choice. She cannot do both these things right now. She cannot have a quiet time and also go feed this crying baby. And, like, the obvious thing, the thing she has to go do is feed the baby. Like, that's the thing she has to do. And also, that's a step forward in just following Jesus, you know. You hold the baby and you pray while you feed the baby. And you do that today instead of reading. And maybe it's going to be months before you get back into whatever routine you liked, you know.
Yeah.
But you can actually finish those months and kind of even think, you know, I had some pretty good moments of following Jesus in those months, even though it wasn't the way I would write it, you know. And that's I like that. He's using us now, now to do it. But also, like, so I think that also with, like, that idea, so, like, why hasn't God gotten rid of this thing, or doesn't he, is an implication of, like, timeline. Like, I think I know what the timeline ought to be, and you're not following it. And that's actually that's actually, like, a thing I think about all the time. What is the timeline in an individual's life? What is the timeline in, you know, the life of the church to solve a problem, to eradicate an evil, to get rid of a thing? What's the timeline in all eternity? In all cases, I don't have an answer for that. So the best thing I could probably do is calm down a little bit and say, like, how are you going to use me? You know.
I also think regarding, like, timelines to do a thing or what have you, I think that's one of those areas where, like, we look at it backwards. We do this a lot. We look at it backwards. I was talking to some friends last Sunday after church. We were talking about life, and does God define life differently than the way we define life? And it was a whole big subject that we were talking about. But ultimately, like, we define life as any kind of natural process that's able to change and grow and then reproduce before it ceases. And this is sort of the working definition of biological life. But maybe God defines life differently. Because one of the things that brought this up is we were talking about the resurrection. And I like to point out that it's implied throughout several passages in the Bible that in the resurrection, we'll be vegetarian or perhaps pescatarian. Mm-hmm. And you can point out that Jesus, post-resurrection, pre-ascension, only eats fish. He doesn't have anything other than any other kind of meat, just fish. And we consider fish alive, but in Jewish literature, they don't. They consider for it something to be alive, it must come from the earth. And fish don't come from the earth. They come from the water. So we were talking about, is God's definition of life different from ours? And one of my friends said, well, we know plants are alive because if you speak to them nicely, they grow really well, and if you speak to them mean, they grow really sad. And I said, is that confessing something about plants or about you?
Yeah.
Right? Like, what's the active force here? Is it the life of, is it the plant that's listening and is happy because you're speaking nice? Or do your words have maybe a bit more power than you think they do?
Right.
And so I think we think about these things sort of backwards sometimes, and maybe when we're talking about timelines and all this, we're the slow ones, not God. God's already defeated the thing, and he's, like, waiting for us to catch up.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
So, actually, that's, like, core of stuff I think about all the time. Yeah, you kind of, like, took my mind to, after Johnny Cash died, his son said something like, you know, my dad's life was just, like, a battle between the darkness and the light. And in the end, the light won, is what he said. And, like, that's pretty awesome. That's the kind of thing. Well, I think that's probably the kind of thing we would really want to hear after somebody who's had an embattled life. You know, we'd really want to hear that. But, like, what's kind of awesome about it to me is that in retrospect, we can do this, but just, like, yeah, timelines are really messy for us, and they are less so for God. So, you know, Johnny Cash was, you know, saved whenever God declared it true, you know, and that, I don't know what that means about the 80s or the 70s or, you know, like, I don't know, I don't, but I do know, like, you know, whatever it is, it's about, you know, so what's cool is, like, the declarative idea, so God, you know, makes a thing true, is we then mimic. So in your example, God declares me alive, you know. He tells me that I am, and by telling me that, it becomes true. That isn't a confession about me being spoken nicely to by God and therefore getting more saved. It's a confession about the performative word of the Lord, right?
Yep.
So how cool is it then that those who have dominion over the earth might mimic that even to a, like, a small degree? And we know it's true even if somebody is listening to this and thinking, I don't think talking to a ficus is going to make a difference. But even if a person can't accept that, although I'm sure there's data.
There is.
We know it about our dogs. We know it about our kids and our neighbors. We know it about, you know, every
ourselves.
Yes. Every other thing, you know, every other living thing we get to interact with shows us this. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I was at work the other day, and some guy, he had to pay for a thing, and he puts his credit card in the machine, and he goes to type in his PIN, and it declined, and it came back, and it said incorrect PIN. And I was like, oh, sorry, bro, you typed your PIN wrong. And he goes, oh, I'm so stupid. What an idiot. I can't believe I did that. And I said, Brother Bear, let me stop you right there. If I had just said that to you just now, if I had said, oh, my gosh, you idiot, you entered your PIN wrong. What? I said, would you be mad at me? He's like, dude, I'd knock you out. I was like, right, so don't say it to yourself. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, that's good.
Watch the self-talk, you know what I mean? Like, if you wouldn't let a stranger say it to you.
Okay, one time last year, I was, like, super tired, and I was at a 7-Eleven buying a bottle of water, and I kept trying to put my $10 bill into the chip card reader.
Perfect.
And I think in that case, if the person behind the counter had been like, are you dumb? I would have been like, okay. In this case, I think even the plant would have responded, you're right. I'm trying to put a $10 bill into a chip card reader. I don't know. But I think you make a good point. Because, like, you just have to believe what – I mean, yeah, that's a – if God says you're a beautiful creation, then you should probably believe that, you know, is the bottom line, right? And you have to talk like that. You have to. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. And some people get weirded out. I grew up Pentecostal, so less so there, and I found more so in Lutheranism. People get a little weirded out, and they're, I guess, worried about, like, word of faith heresy kind of stuff, which I get. I get that. But there is a way in which, like, if God says a thing, you should also confess that thing. If God says that you are forgiven, then, like, that's the you should confess that thing. You should confess your sin, of course. I'm not denying that. But, like, you shouldn't mope around and go, oh, man, God doesn't love me. I can't be saved. No, because that's not what God says. So who's lying here, right?
Yeah, that's right. Every once in a while, usually a younger person wants to talk to me about how do I pray about my deceased loved one. And I kind of find that I kind of go there often with them first. Like, I love that you want to pray about them. That's good. You're having feelings and you want to turn to God with them. And that is the thing we should do. And also, you really want to know that your loved one is with Jesus, you know? And so that's a right, reasonable thing to be feeling too. But we also have to trust his declarative promises right now. So if we're going to pray about your loved one, you know, like for them even, or if you want to talk in those terms, let's make sure we do it in a way that is trusting in their baptism, for example, and is not hoping that their baptism works, you know, kind of way, which is a thing we might do. We're not praying for a soul in purgatory. We are praying for somebody who had the promise laid over them that they are a child of God. And so let's pray prayers of thanksgiving for that promise. Let's pray prayers of hope that we will join them in that reality. But let's make sure that everything we're praying is actually consistent with what God told us. That's really super important. And if he says it, then it's kind of got to be true too.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So you grew up Pentecostal. I went to a Pentecostal college.
Oh, sorry.
A big upside to it was that I met my wife there. And,
huge upside.
And she's like the best Lutheran I know now. But yeah, I went to, it's called Lee University. Do you know it? You ever heard of it? The denomination is Church of God. Cleveland, Tennessee is the Church of God. But I wanted to go to school. I grew up in Ann Arbor, like right next to a Concordia. And so I wanted to study youth ministry. And Like, I didn't, like, literally did not get a piece of literature from Concordia at all. Like, I did, they never, like, reached out. And so I was like, yeah, well, I hear those things. Ah, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't a problem in my brain at all to head down south and go to this Pentecostal college. So take that, you know, like, it didn't even occur to me as anything close to a contradiction of my Lutheran confession.
Right.
In my, the church that I grew up in, especially like back in the 90s, was pretty wild. Like, it was an LCMS church, and I saw people like give like testimonies, as in like prophecies in the service back in the 90s. Like, it, a word of the Lord would come to them. You're probably actually familiar with this kind of thing, right? Like, a word of the Lord would come to them, and they would go up and like whisper into somebody's ear, like, I want to share this. And at toward the end of the service, more than one time in my life, I saw that happen. So I'm thankful for the church, because it was, I think it was an on-ramp for my non-Lutheran parents kind of moving toward, you know, where we are today, which is a whole bunch of people with LSBs at home, even like home copies of LSBs, you know. But yeah, so I was kind of Lutheran, but I wanted to study youth ministry. And this school down there, they were super cheap compared to most schools. It was like, I graduated high school in 06. That's when I went. So it was like $15,000 for a year with room and board for of like liberal arts degree. And they had a youth ministry program. So I was like, well, I'm going to go do that. And I always say that that's how I became a Lutheran, was going to that Pentecostal college. I was like, I don't know exactly what I believe, but I'm pretty sure it's not this. It's kind of how I felt the whole time. Actually, I learned some really important lessons. So, like, later I started to kind of read things. In seminary, I was given some readings on, like, I cannot remember. I'm, like, in the moment having – I can't remember who writes this. But basically, is it helpful – what's the best way to, like, split Christians in America? Is it conservative and progressive? I think Twitter is proof that that's not true, because like you go to like conservative Christian Twitter and it's still a bloodbath, right? Like, you know, and it's like, wait, it does not feel like we're all kind of close to the same group. But amongst conservatives, and even with some more progressive people put in, you actually do have a better chance of defining a group of ideology in like confessionalism. So basically, like, those who are confessional are probably a smart group to put together. That makes sense, because we're more alike when we're confessional, even if we have different expressions of confession or even different confessions. Being, like, holding fast to a confession is a thing that makes a Christian more like that group than being conservative or progressive. And then on the other side, the non-confessional groups probably are more like each other in that way. Even, and this one even more so, far-right conservative groups that are non-confessional and far-left progressive groups that are non-confessional have actually some pretty similar approaches to things. You know, like, you know, they do that. And so at my school, which was a conservative Christian school but non-confessional, you had an amazingly liberal, like, anthropology and English department, and an amazingly conservative Bible department, but then even within that Bible department, you'd have people who were like, you know, a woman wrote Hebrews, and Jonah is a parable, and like, so like it was a complete like inbreeding of, it was completely like mixed up. It was so I just thought like conservative, you know, that means a thing. And what I learned there and was able to kind of see in retrospect is that's actually probably not right. These people lacked a confession, and so When you don't have a confession, anything goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's been a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see it. The church I grew up at, you'd say is conservative, in that they like won't perform a gay wedding,
right?
I guess, but totally down with female pastors.
Yeah.
So like, that's not conservative, though, you know, but I realize that, like, what you're saying, like, that may be conservative, but it's not confessional, you know.
And, well, probably not conservative even, though, when you push it, because what are you conserving, you know? It's kind of,
What have conservatives ever conserved?
Well, there are probably some true conservatives. They probably don't have a lot of friends, and they probably aren't on the internet if they're true conservatives. I don't know. I think about it like this: like the most progressive worship in the country is generally linked to conservative Christians, right? Like the most progressive forms of like worship, like mm-hmm. those are the people who have the most like. I mean, you find a lady pastor in a round collar, and they're probably singing from a hymnal at her church. You know, like that's yeah. generally how it's. So it's not that helpful, probably, to use those terms because it doesn't actually mean. I don't think it means what we think it means, you know. But then tying it to confession is actually super helpful. And I was only half joking when I said that if I came on this, I wanted to talk about like country music, law, gospel, things like that, because I actually think that that's it's a place where we can look for a pretty good expression of kind of like folk religion in our country over time.
Okay.
And it demonstrates to us, there are good ways to look at it, ways that I think are really helpful. And there are other things that could be super depressing because they show what we actually believe sometimes, you know, mm-hmm. sometimes. But I think it's a place that's like told, that tells the story of what it tells two stories. It tells a story of what I want pretty well, you know, like doing what I want pretty well, which is kind of like a thing that America has known well. And also it kind of tells this recurring story of being brought back from doing what I want, like pretty well too. So, I mean, the best example is that like you get a guy like Hank Williams who sings, you know, like if you got the money, I got the time, you know, or like, I don't know, it's going out and drinking songs or like I love you songs or you kick me out of the house again songs. And it's like kind of like, we see the dark, difficult side of life, right? And this, Hank Williams at this point is like darn near about 100 years ago, or 80, 90 years ago, he started recording, right? So he's singing those songs, that's important because we're singing those exact same songs today if you listen to modern country music, you know? Mm-hmm. But then, like, the next song in his album would be I Saw the Light, you know? Like, I wandered so aimless, life filled with sin. I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. You see, you have some decision theology there, but even still, like he's starting to tell a story of kind of like an ebb and flow between sinner and, you know, saint, so to speak. And then the next song on his album is like I'm a Rambling Man, about how he can't stay home, you know. And then the next song on his album is The Lost Highway, about how I started going on the lost highway, and actually starts to kind of like take on a form of like confession, you know, like I think confession, maybe depending on the album, the singer, all those things, missing kind of like declaration of absolution, you know, but like it starts to actually look similar to what kind of God tells us to do about things. The trouble though, and this is why, like, when I said confession just now, I was talking confession of sin, you know, but this is why confession, like, of faith matters, is a lot of times when you get to that, like, rock bottom of, like, we see this in the singers' lives very much, like, I have done everything I wanted, and it's broken me real bad, you know, like, I've got nothing, and Jesus, I need you. They get there, and then there's not a confession which informs a pattern of life to go forward. You know, we're using terms like I backslid again. I got to get on the straight and narrow. You know, I got to do these things. But they're not handed the gift that is, here's how you can live a life, you know, like free of this. No one is saying, hey, we're really glad to see you.'t beat yourself up too much this week. Just come back next week and I'll make the same promises about Jesus to you again, you know, kind of thing. Right. No one's saying that. No one's saying, hey, I know you want some big changes. Don't quit your job. You don't have to do that. It doesn't have to be like, something, you know, like that intense. Maybe just, you know, how about we catch lunch on Wednesday and we'll see how it's going. You know, like we don't have that. We don't have patterns of just kind of like discipleship to hand people in those cases. And so like they have to keep then telling the same story. And that's Johnny Cash's battle between the darkness and the light, I think. Like I get to the place because I've been given enough kind of the law growing up, I get to the place of confession, I can actually connect, and because it's written on my heart, you know, I have sinned, and I'm therefore full of sorrow. But I don't have any way of kind of like living in life kind of after that, you know?
Yeah.
That's a thing that happens in those places. And I think actually it's, derivative of the lack of confession in a lot of those places. They might know the Bible really well, but I don't have any tools. And unfortunately, like the way, if you're going to keep going down that like line of thinking, you might actually get to a place where modern hymnody does a very similar thing. It takes me to a place of like confession. Hymnody is probably not the best word, but like modern worship songs could do a really similar thing where I get to the place where I'm at rock bottom and I just said some vague stuff about how Jesus could pick me up from there. But as I'm walking out, I don't actually know what that could look like or what I should do about that or, you know, what could tomorrow be, you know, unless I could have another experience like I just had now, which felt pretty good, you know, kind of thing. And in that sense, I think like it's kind of, it remains kind of folk religion then, you know, it's like, we're just kind of telling the same story again, but now in slightly different ways.
Right. Different names, different locations, but the same kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's also a trouble though, like, well, what kind of music do you listen to? If you're listening to like just your music in the car, what are you listening to?
Heavy metal.
Okay. Do you listen to Christian heavy metal?
Some of the bands are Christians, yeah. I don't know that I mean, there's some bands that are pretty explicitly Christian, Wolves at the Gate, For Today, a few others. But other bands where it's just like, we're just here making music. Like, we're all Christians, but like, we're just making music.
Right.
And then a lot of non-Christian stuff too.
Well, I think that if you're talking about like music as expression of confession or not, or lack of confession, you know, like, to some degree, the kind of music it is actually kind of matters a little bit. Like, in other words, I would give some credence to the complaints that people nowadays struggle with organ music because they've never heard an organ in their life before, you know, or they have, but only in a context that they literally hated, you know, and it, you know, has meant nothing. Like, there's some reasonable... And like, you know, people get kind of grumpy, like, why do you teach the classics better? I'm okay with that, you know. I teach my kids to, you know, like last week I was working on a alto line of a hymn with my daughter because I want her to be able to do that kind of thing. I think it's great. I love it. She also has a very different home life than most everybody on earth because her dad is a Lutheran pastor and into that kind of thing. So, but I do think like, so in conversations about instrumentation then do start to matter because of how connected they are to also where we're going to express our lyrics, right? Mm-hmm. And I think when something is like closer to a folk expression, that's actually a good thing, generally speaking. So in American history, white music and black music, for example, white people music, black people music, have been really close to each other, like walked alongside of each other in a lot of ways, and you get amazing crossovers, you know. Mm-hmm. And even like in the pop world today, they've really kind of blended, you know, and it, you know, like blended in a way that's like really interesting and wonderful and great. In the, you know, 70s, you had a really popular like black country singer, Charlie Pride, who like was just, you know, right there doing the same thing. But even better than that was like Ray Charles making a country album, you know, back then, in a way that it's like collaborating with all these other people doing these things. But also those were big moments and they couldn't have happened even like 20 years before that. But I think what I'm getting at is this, like the music that is folk music can be a really helpful way to try to like communicate the gospel to people. But if we're going to do that, we need to also be touching on the narrative approach of folk music. So pop music, in so far as it is narrative, it tells a story, does good things. If we could like draw that out, we might be able to do wonderful things with Christian, like, you know, ideas, right? It's when we don't and we get like, what's the 7-11, like seven words 11 times, you know, music that does it, that like,
yeah.
It stops telling the story and therefore it stops telling stories at all and therefore isn't a very useful like tool for telling the gospel, which is essentially a story, right? Like it needs to do that. So hymns would do that well. I think hymns and history do that well because they're kind of folk music, right? Like that's why, yeah. Like, you know, like Bach was kind of writing folk music in a sense, you know, and mm-hmm. like, and so you can tell a story well with it. I think the same is true with like country music. And I think that it, like in some culture then, probably heavy metal does it really well too. If you can tell, but you have to be able to tell a story in the thing.
Yeah.
I don't think the music we choose very often nowadays in worship, I don't think it always tells a story. It's not even intent on telling a story. It doesn't connect to like our folk vibes very well.
We pulled out a hymn the other day and I looked down at the, I always like to look down and see who writes the hymns, who writes the music, whatever. And it was, I forget what the hymn was. So when I say that it was super impacting, no one's going to believe me. But it was just really like theologically, like super deep lyrics. And so I was like, who wrote this? This is mm-hmm. like, this is gold. And I looked down at the bottom and it's some long dead saint wrote this hymn in 300 something AD. It's like the earliest recorded of these words or whatever. And I was like, dear
Lord. Hold on. Someone's knocking on my window. That's awkward. Sorry. That's long dead saint. Go, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah. And I was like, just think like our people, we have been singing this song for like almost as long as we've been here. Right? Like over 1,000 years, I'm singing this song with like an ancient church.
Right.
And I don't know, like, I think there's a way in which like that's, as Christians, like we should have our own kind of culture and we should do, I think we do have a culture and I think we have kind of a responsibility to pull people in and say like, look, this is, like historically, this is who we are, and you know, and like connect people back to that. I don't think we do a good enough job of that, especially not like the modern American kind of expression of evangelical Christianity.
Yeah, right. Now, especially So, like, if we have any perspective that's like, well, I mean, a lot of times we're like literally like hostile toward that culture. Like we're like, wait, hey, is that would you say that was in the culture for a long time? Yeah, okay, then I don't want to be part of that, you know. It's kind of like how we do that. And I get that, and like, yeah, that's a pretty wild thing. But I also think like the narrative of the gospel of Jesus Christ is so potent and so like it is all that if it is the church's culture, it should weave like a thread, you know, essentially from the year, it should weave like a thread from the year 33 to today, you know, like we should be able to see post-resurrection Christian culture flowing in this way. And I think we generally do in the true church. Now, what's difficult about that is like, you get some pretty like light moments down there where it's like, where was the Christian culture in, you know, 1518? Well, it was in Luther's hammer. And flowing through that, if the church was not making a true confession, you know, kind of thing. So you get those things too. But also, I think I find that like, if you, and you do this more than I do, but when you sit down to someone with a different like confession in American evangelical Christianity, and you start talking with them, they nod their head in agreement a lot. Like they like the way we're describing this stuff. And they're like, did you like... and I'm like, and what's awesome is I don't have to do it. Jesus does it for me. You know, I say Luther's line from the Heidelberg Disputation, you know, the law says do this and it's never done. The gospel says, you know, everything is already done for you. You know, it's, and they're like, yeah, that sounds awesome. That's what I want. That's great. Cool. Okay, then let me show you. Like, and then, and it's like, so come back to the culture then which the culture is the gospel. That's the core of what I guess what I'm getting at. The culture is the gospel. And I do think, though, that for somebody who has been, you know, made alive in faith in Christ, that's attractive when you can really kind of lay it out in a way that is, they can see it. You know, when I can actually say something like the gospel, I don't, you know, people aren't like, that's dumb, I hate that, you know, like credo baptism rules. That's not how that goes. They're just kind of like, interesting, because I have not had that expression. And we've seen that in recent years with like the return to high church. I mean, like everybody moved, trying to get high, you know, like in like trying to like get to more of that kind of stuff. I think it's because the culture for us actually is the gospel. So the places where it is, you know, is attractive eventually. There's this other thing in like, in American history, I think I'm interested in a lot is that like, even groups who would not confess stuff that we do, like infant baptism, or just like, let's just say baptismal regeneration. Okay. Even people who in history would not do that. Fanny Crosby is one of the like the most famous hymn writers in American history. She wrote like, I think she collaborated with this one guy. They collaborated together in tunes and poems on like 1,500 hymns. And that's just like that. This guy, like William, I think his last name is like Doan or something like that. Anyway, they collaborated on 1,500 alone. They wrote a lot of hymns. She wrote lots more, and some really Blessed Assurance. That's hers, you know, stuff like that. So she was a Baptist. He was a Baptist. They were not baptismal regeneration people. And yet they wrote songs that sang about like they write songs that sing about healing waters, the River of Jordan as a place to go, you know, you go for life and you cross through it and you come out on the other side in like victory. Now some of that is like other shore Book of Revelation language, but like one of them, they wrote together, it's called Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross. And it's got this cool, like very biblical language of like, I glory in the cross. So like, Jesus, keep me near the cross. And this verse goes, there a precious fountain, free to all, a healing stream flows from Calvary's mountain. So like, that's Old Testament imagery for sure. But a healing stream, like for us, seems like we would only be talking about one thing. Yeah. Sounds like a font to me. Yeah, right. And then the chorus is, you know, like in the cross, be my glory ever till my, I think they use the word raptured, but they're not talking about like the rapture, but, you know, like lifted, right? That till my raptured soul shall find peace beyond the river. That's the song. Two Baptists write it. I don't know what they were thinking about, but what I would just say is like, I think this is to me a moment where like, you can't even help but confess the right thing if you're using the like scriptural language, and that ties to Christian culture. You know, it has to.
Yeah,
maybe that's crazy. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so because I, after I became a Lutheran, I had many friends and family members even come to me and say, "Hey, what do you guys believe about the Lord's Supper?" And so then, oh, well, it's bread and wine, and it's the body and blood of Christ, and it forgives sins. There we go. And I had, I mean, probably half a dozen friends and family members at this point, half a dozen people total that I've talked to that said, you know, I believe that, like, just from, like, reading the Bible.
I'm
believing that, but like if I bring it up at church, people look at me like I'm crazy, you know. But steep yourself in it, you're gonna get there. I think
that's exactly right. If you are messing around with the Bible, you can't. It's really, I mean, unless you're totally alone. But if you are, you know, if you're totally alone, you can go into your room and come out with any wild interpretation you want. But if like I find exactly what you just described, more so than baptism, which is a little more difficult. The kind of like, we have to be, it takes more exegetical like homework to demonstrate either, I think, you know, credo or pedo Baptist, you know, position, right? You just, it's just, more going on. There's more texts that are more difficult with, but the Lord's Supper just says, this is my body. And then it has a bunch of people saying, we're going to eat his body, you know, where we ate his body, right, or when you eat his body, you know. And so I find with people who come to my church from evangelical traditions, and we have a lot of that here, I don't have to work at all to convince them that the Lord's Supper is true presence. It is, especially when I give them the helpful language of saying in, with, and under in a way we don't understand. Right. That, because that solves the thing. They're like, okay, good. Because if you would tell me that, like, this is only that, I would say this still looks like a, you know, a wafer to me, and I'd say, oh
well, let me tell you about accidents and substance.
Yeah, right. Exactly right. They don't have trouble with that generally. It's like, that's not that hard. Baptism takes longer because there's more to figure out there about. Like, that is actually like the core of, once you come around on baptism, decision theology and works righteousness and your confession have basically died off now. Like, but that's like, it's the last kind of like twitching breaths of kind of like my wanting to be the one to have done something here, you know, kind of thing. It's that, yeah, it just takes a little while. I totally see that. And I think that, like, that potency of gospel truth then actually starts to drip out in a way where we can celebrate it when we see it other places, and then start to try to use that as a way to encourage a person to see that there could be more, you know.
Yeah.
There could be more. Even when when an atheist accidentally tells writes a Christ film or something, you know, and we can say, I actually had a professor at the seminary who'd say that was his very theory, was like, the gospel is just so potent that it spills over into almost every story everywhere. And so if anyone's telling any kind of story, you're probably will be able to, you know, read God's truth into it so easily, because that person didn't even know they were doing it, but they were, you know.
Yeah. Got to be careful with that, though, or you, I don't know. That can also be dangerous.
Oh, you can't equate it with gospel. I don't mean to say that.
Right,
at all.
Yeah.
You know, which would be super dangerous. But then the question, and this is like what I was saying about, you know, a God thing earlier, is, it's not that I can say God wrote this, you know, wicked thing. You know, like, I'm saying that he inspired you, like, scripture, to write this wicked thing because this thing is so potent. But I could say as a Christian is, look at this. Even in this corrupt story, I could see that this at least is good. I might still say, I'm not going to let my kids watch that, or I'm not watching that ever again, or right, turn it off now. But, you know, like, I have the ability, the gift, because of the Holy Spirit, to actually, like, see goodness where God puts it.
Yeah. Wow. Like country music.
I think so. I mean, I don't really listen to any country music that was recorded after like 1985. So that's not actually totally true either, because I'm not saying there's not redeeming qualities there. But I don't listen to much of it because there's less of it there. I think like there is, it stopped being the folk music for a large group of America, Americans. It stopped kind of connecting there. It still is for some people, and I'm sure there's still good stories being told, or at least stories being told that could be used to see truth, good or bad truth. Other people started connecting with other things, and the folk expression of most young people is probably better represented in, like, what was that thing about, I'm going to rot the Old Town Road. Old Town Road song, remember that one?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like, kind that's probably folk music. So. Hey, I have a question for you. So you call this Lutheran Answers. Is that a nod to the radio show, The Catholic Answers?
So Catholic Answers is really big, and I started this thinking, you know what, we need that, but like with the truth. So here we go.
So I'm interested in that because I actually was a caller on Catholic Answers one time, like 12 years ago. I was going through like confused days of being at a Pentecostal college and having generally Lutheran like upbringing, but still like kind of confused about stuff. And like like a lot of confused young people started to be like, I wonder what these guys are doing, you know? So I would listen to Catholic Answers every once in a while. And I called to ask them about like conversion experiences, because I don't know about your Pentecostal upbringing, but the church, the school I was at, it was basically, we're looking for a road to Damascus experience in mm-hmm. all conversions.
Oh yeah.
You got to be able to tell the story about your conversion being this like big thing. And I can remember a day like doing a sinner's prayer before I was a Lutheran with my mom. I was like maybe like 5. But actually, I think given the tools she had, it was the exact right thing, because I was confessing Christ as Lord. It was perfect. And I think of that still, even now. It was before I was baptized. I was baptized when I was 7. But I think of that still as the day that I'm pretty certain I was a Christian. I'm really thankful for the baptism. Super thankful for knowing that it wasn't, you know. But anyway, and they actually gave me a good and true answer, which was, we wouldn't say that. We would say, you know, basically, a child is raised in the faith and given, you know, like certainty of it at their baptism, and you don't need a road to Damascus experience, you know, to have that. So my one experience with them was actually one where they gave an answer pretty similar to probably how I would now, you know.
Yeah.
Point a kid back to his parents.
Yeah, they've always been really cool. We've interacted on Twitter quite a bit. They've always been really cool people over there. So I've managed to develop friendships with several Catholics and even a few priests, which has been really cool. Really been a huge blessing. Especially to be able to like I'm really like noodling something and I can't quite like figure out the words to say. I tell you what, so my buddy's grandfather said this to me one day. He said, you want to study biology, you ask a biologist. You want to study engineering, you ask an engineer. You want to study Christianity, you ask a Roman Catholic, because we've been doing it for 2000 years. And a very Catholic line, for him, but they do have words for things sometimes that like I'm struggling to like get an idea, and being able to shoot off a text to a priest friend and be like, hey, what am I trying to say here? Right. And them coming back and saying, well, this is how we say it. And it's like, oh yeah, okay, I see, like,
yeah, right,
I see where we're going with this.
Exactly. That is absolutely right. And like the word concupiscence, how about that one? You know that one? I don't, you know, we talk about that in different ways, but it sure is a helpful term, right? Like it's like, that's actually, I don't know what else, you know, probably we have other versions of saying that, but actually it's like got helpful precision in talking about like a tendency to sin, right? And even sometimes I'm sure the words you get describe a thing that you don't agree with, but it's helpful that they gave you a term to know up to use, and you know, and not.
Yeah, and I can at least differentiate. And I do have Lutheran pastors, including my own pastor, that I reach out to as well when I struggle with things. It's nice to be able to have the perspectives, you know. But I find English is really clumsy for theology. English is really bad for theology because it's so imprecise, at least modern English. Perhaps there are more English words that have fallen out of use or that I can look up and use. You know, I try and read as many like dead people as I can, but there's still, like, we had in our adult Bible study, we're going through just sort of Lutheran dogmatics. And we had a, that's my wife. We had a guy who, we were talking about the resurrection and how there won't be any evil in the resurrection and how it'll be perfect. It'll be perfect in the resurrection. And as we're talking about this, he says how, like, you're never going to fall and skin your knee. And I realized we're both saying perfection, and we are having two completely different conversations. because I'm talking about sinless perfection. But we're still going to be like human beings. If I walk up a grassy hill with dew on it, I might slip. You know? Is that a result of sin? That, you know, I slip sometimes, that I trip over something, or, you know what I mean? And so that's, but because we're both, because perfection can be rightly used to describe both things, here we are with this imprecision of English,
right,
sort of being clumsy around these rather delicate ideas. That happens a lot, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've thought, so, and, you know, like, and time does it too. So, like, eternal truths that were largely, in our case, like discussed at least at length in like 1500s Germany, you know, and then like going and before, but also especially there, and then kind of flowing now down to us. And now we have like time as a thing. We have the issue of them being eternal truths, mysteries of God that have been given to us to whatever degree they have. And then we also do have the problem of language that nobody really seems to like, but you know, we're kind of all stuck with. Back to me tutoring a guy, and he's like, "Why does it do that?" And I'm like, "I don't know, man. It just does." My wife, when she's teaching our kids to read, is always saying that, you know, and that's just a fun one of those funny English things she'll say.
Yeah,
but you know, I think about like the frivolous theology discussion that is like referenced in like old-timey is, I think, like, you know, 1500s, is how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Have you heard that one? Like, yeah. That's like, yeah. So, okay, I guess I get that idea, but I've always assumed that that, like, made more sense as, like, a little, like, conversation, I don't know. Like, maybe the idea just kind of, like, comes on over, but I've always kind of been like, that never seemed like the most helpful example to me. And I've wondered if I wasn't limited in by time and also language and to kind of like fully kind of understanding like the frivolousness of this, because I don't know, it's kind of interesting to me to think about whether or not I'd skin my knee, which is a similar kind of conversation. But on the other hand, it's really hard to feel like I got anywhere with it. You know, I had a similar conversation where we were arguing about whether or not would there have been naturally occurring forest fires in the Garden of Eden to clear out the underbrush, like, which are a good thing in our world, you know?
Well, like even hurricanes in our world, hurricanes are seen as evil and, you know, this destructive force of nature that comes and wipes out cities, does untold damage to places like New Jersey and before that Louisiana. But studies are showing now that marshlands on the coast actually help dampen and lessen hurricanes, and one of the reasons why hurricanes seem to be so bad is because we're draining and paving all these marshlands, and so there's this natural humid sticky trap for hurricanes that we're destroying. And the hurricanes themselves are fighting erosion. The beaches get eroded from all the waves all year round. A hurricane blows through and dumps tens of thousands of pounds of sand on the beach.
Right.
And so it's like, here's this thing that we look at as evil, but it's like, it's a natural process that's actually incredibly beneficial. Like, we're just, my stupid house is in the way is all.
That's exactly right. So I was out in North Dakota this summer. My wife grew up there, and I was talking with someone. They were telling me, I'd never heard about it, and I don't remember what it's called. Farmers do this thing where they get in an airplane, and they fly into a storm, like up in, someone will do this, and then they, like, put a chemical in the rain clouds, which is supposed to keep it from hailing, is what they do, because hail ruins crops, right? And so it's like people, and they do it in different parts of the world too. I can't remember what it's called. They go up there, they fly, they put this chemical into the rainstorm to make it so that it won't hail. And all I thought was, this is how we're going to find out how important hail was. Yeah. This is like, we don't know what it is, but this is how we're going to find out. It took me days to, like, get over the shock of the idea that we were literally trying to affect the weather. we're going to, I mean, I'm sure that if we could put a chemical on the hurricanes to make them stop, you know, be, or be less so, we'd be doing that too. And we are, and our beaches would erode, right? Is what would happen. That's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe we should be less dependent on corn. Maybe that's the thing we should work on.
We love corn in America, though. We love it. Yeah, we use corn for everything.
That's right. That's right. I think it's like way more places than we even could guess. Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Sam, thanks for being here, man.
Dude, it's fun.
It was fun.
I'm glad you do this. I think it's cool that you have gotten a lot of different like voices, particularly voices I see interacting with, you know, ideas on Twitter. That's totally fun. Mm-hmm. In a way to just kind of like have healthy conversations about things. It's great.
Awesome. Anything I can plug for you? Your church, your Twitter? I got those in my show notes. Anything else?
No, man. I'm just a pastor and husband. I'm just kidding. That's the Twitter thing we make fun of all the time, right? Pastor husbands. No, that's great. You don't even have to plug those if you don't want. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. Well, it was a good time. And I will, I guess, talk to you soon.
Well, hope so.